Sisi's regime allowed the people to express their feeling and demonstrate only because of the pressure put to him by the Western government to open the Rafah crossing and implement the so-called deal of the century by the transfer of the Palestinian from Gaza to Sinai to live there permanently. Israel is saying temporarily, but the idea is to transfer the Palestinian and let them live in Sinai and leave Gaza for Israel to annex Gaza like they did with all the occupied Arab land.
And speaking of pressure, so it's not just the pressure that the people are putting on their governments in Egypt, it's also the pressure of the people worldwide that are now having an effect. You know, Noor, if I can come to you, you know, we've seen the huge question of are protests and boycotts working? You know, what's the use? We've got thousands of people on the streets. They're taking days off of work. Do they really have an effect? What can you tell us about these kind of protests across the Muslim world?
The protests that have been taking place aren't just across the Muslim world. We've also noticed all of these protests taking place in Europe, for instance, in London, where we had over 500,000 people marching together to stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people. And the way I sort of measure the effectiveness of these protests and these boycotts is by looking at the reaction of elites. Look at the reaction of the Israeli lobby. Look at the reaction of Suella Braverman, for example, by trying to ban the Palestinian flag. Or, for instance, the reaction of Keir Starmer that fired Andy McDonald for simply asking for a ceasefire. These are sort of extreme measures, and the reaction from these from sort of the Israeli lobby and from Western governments goes to show how effective these protests are. And that's because, as well, the Israeli regime will attempt as hard as they can to make sure that the Western public opinion remains pro-Israel. So when this now that they're losing sort of the monopoly on the narrative, that then puts pressure on Western governments to change their stance towards the Israeli occupying entity. And we saw that with Keir Starmer, for instance, when he sort of did that U-turn, when he went onto LBC and incited genocide and said that Palestinians don't deserve water, electricity and fuel, and then had to U-turn the next day and go for photo ops with leaders of mosques, for instance. And so these protests sometimes can actually create tangible change on the ground. I mean, we saw the Iraqis that went to the border with Jordan and said that, you know, they refused for subsidized oil to go from Iraq into the Israeli occupying entity. We saw protests happening in Egypt where people are camping by the border, by the occupied Palestine border, asking their government to open the Rafah crossing to allow aid and the injured to come in. You know, these protests have erupted, for instance, in Jordan, where we've got, you know, a massive population of Palestinian people. And that sort of, you know, we saw that even Queen Rania had to come into CNN to now, you know, even though Jordan takes the position of, you know, normalizing with Israel and, you know, has ties with them, but what was almost felt obligated to come out and speak for the Palestinian people because it was almost embarrassing not to. Mm. The same with Turkey's Erdogan. You know, he has open relations with the Israeli entity, but had to sort of come out and say the Palestinians have the right to, have the right to resistance because it simply would have been embarrassing not to say that. And when it comes to sort of creating real tangible change on the ground, the US may not call for a ceasefire if people, you know, start to step on the US toes. If, for example, the people in West Asia begin storming the US embassies, you know, they wouldn't want their interests sort of jeopardized. So they then might call for a ceasefire. And in terms of sort of boycotts as well. Boycotts have also been extremely effective. I mean, we saw McDonald's and Starbucks handing out, you know, free burgers to the IDF as if, a lot of the IDF soldiers are actually obese. They don't need any more burgers. Instead of giving, food and fuel and donations to the people of Gaza that are literally facing a genocide, they have decided to, offer freebies and goods. And, you know, these are capitalist multinational corporations, and where it hits them and hurts them the most is in their pockets. So I would say continue with protests, continue with boycotts, because they are effective.
Asante, I think that you mentioned quite a lot of the effects that have been enacted on the ground in lots of, not only just in the UK, but obviously, and you didn't mention Lebanon. I remember seeing this video of the people just literally like in their thousands, in their cars, just rushing to the embassy to kick these ambassadors out of their offices. And do you know what? as someone who regularly goes to these protests and actually asks people for their opinion, I definitely feel that that feeling is coming to the UK. And what we're going to be seeing now is, in contrast to how many Muslim leaders have reacted, ordinary Muslims have also been active in showing their solidarity to the Palestinian people. Ion Islam spoke to some attendees at a recent protest in London to ask them if they felt these leaders were failing in their responsibility to the Muslims of Gaza.
As a Muslim, it's shameful. It's absolutely shameful that these major world powers with a lot of wealth, a lot of oil, all they could have done was turn off the black taps, yeah? That's all they had to do. And they could have helped the narrative, okay? I think, you know, turning off the taps to countries like America and Israel, that would have had a major impact, okay? And I think all the Muslim countries have been very slow talking about it, never mind the actions. The actions have not come at all. If anything, Qatar has been outspoken about the whole thing, but again, there's a lot more they could do, and it's shameful. As a Muslim, I'm completely ashamed of the action or the lack of action or reaction from the powerful Muslim leaders of this world.
I don't believe this is a war just against Palestine, but it's an injustice and a war between the evil and the good, because that's what we're fighting. And I just want to say that we're not scared as a Muslim, as a convert. We're not scared. We trust in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We trust in God. We trust in the humanity. And they're all united that to this, to end with the Zionists, and that we know that even in the Quran says this has to happen. So we just have to keep our faith strong and remain together as humans. It doesn't matter what the big countries are doing or not doing. The main thing is that we remain together and we have our faith strong.
Now, the Muslim nation, there are 56 Muslim countries that could do a lot more. And so far, really happy to see what Qatar is doing. It's a small nation, and yet it's very involved and very vocal. They are keeping ties with Hamas, with the brothers as well, so with other Muslim countries, and that's how you're going to get support, whereas other Muslim countries have broken their ties with Hamas, which you cannot have a negotiation if you can't have a tie with them. Really disappointed with other countries. Yesterday, the United Nations had a resolution pushed through for a ceasefire. As much as it's not binding and it's probably just a little soundbite, you've seen countries like Iraq abstain from it, Tunisia abstain from it. It's very shameful. At least speak out. We're not going to see anyone act on it. We're not going to see any sort of support from any Muslim countries. But for God's sake, at least speak out. When you have a voice, speak out and say something.
Well, no one can doubt that the views of the London population are definitely with the people of Gaza. Doctor, if I can come back to you. Nord mentioned slightly about the oil and, you know, the Iraqis going to Jordan. Why haven't the countries cut the oil? I remember that there was a statistic that said something like a sixth of the world's oil is with the countries. You know, if they were to cut the oil, that would cause a shock to the global economy, surely, and it would put the West on notice. Why haven't they done that?
Because we don't have statesmen in the Gulf area to do that, like what we saw after the 1967 war and 1973 war, where Faisal of Saudi Arabia cut gradually the oil production. He didn't boycott completely, but cut the oil production by 5% every month, and we saw the effect on the West on putting pressure on Israel. So we don't have statesmen to do that now. We don't have Arab unity and Muslim unity to see that killing and the genocide we see in Gaza today affect every Arab citizen in the whole of the Arab world and every Muslim citizens in the Muslim world. So if they have that feeling, they would have certainly hurt the Western interests, because the West is blindly supporting the Israeli genocide. And we hear Joe Biden saying that we will stand with Israel today, tomorrow, and every day. It means that forever they are supporting Israel blindly, which make Biden, the United States, and the Western governments complicit to the war crimes committed by the Zionist entity. So this is the situation now. While all the West are supporting the Israelis, none of the Arab world supporting the Palestinian really strongly and effectively. Okay, the Arab street is protesting and demonstrating, which is good in exposing their own regimes and their failure to help the Palestinians. But there is no action really to support the Palestinians by oil ban to the West, and also boycotting, as Noor said rightly. Where is the Arab boycott, which we used to practice until the 73 war? It made a lot of international corporation change their attitude towards this Arab-Israeli conflict.
You know, the question of Arab unity is definitely something that lots of people are talking about. And I think when Yemen kind of, you know, said that they're going to be, they've declared war against Israel, so many people in the Muslim community felt very empowered by it until they realized it was the Houthis who did it. And then yet again, you know, that brief moment of unity was like, oh, no, they're the wrong type of Arab, the wrong type of Muslim.
Because the West call and Israel propaganda, any resistance to the occupation is terrorism. Any resistance to oppression is terrorism. When was resisting occupation and oppressors and land grabber called terrorism? So at least, again, as Noor said, the protest in the Western capitals exposed their regimes again, that what we are seeing in Palestine is legitimate resistance, it is not terrorist act. And as the Secretary General of the United Nations said, that Hamas attacks did not come out of a vacuum.
And that's definitely something that now the public are starting to acknowledge, you know, that they're moving away from this narrative of, oh, it's just started on the 7th of October. They're looking at it in a greater vacuum, absolutely. In a greater context. Noor, if I can come to you about Iran. You know, we were just briefly mentioning about, you know, Arab unity, Muslim unity. You know, has Iran done enough?
Okay. Well, Iran, unlike a majority of Arab countries, has stood by the Palestinian people from day one. If I can just remind everyone that during the 1980s, when Iran was going through one of the most brutal wars, where the world powers conspired against Iran in an eight-year brutal war, they still sent men to Lebanon, to South Lebanon, and to Palestine to fight the Israeli invasion. So they have always stood by the Palestinian people and always extended a helping hand and never fell short in that sense. Compare that to, for example, the Palestinian Authority themselves, Mahmoud Abbas, when the Ma'badani hospital happened and the people in the West Bank went out to protest. And, you know, it was a televised genocide, a televised war crime that took place. And he shot at his own protesters, killing and wounding quite a few of them. Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, they've all been involved in sort of stopping the Yemenis from launching missiles into the Israeli occupation entity, almost protecting it. Just want to remind Iran, remind the world that Iran actually spearheads the resistance axis. What does that consist of? Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, the Palestinian resistance. In Lebanon, Lebanon is involved in a direct confrontation with the Israeli occupation entity on the southern Lebanese border and the northern occupied Palestine border. They have literally covered the entirety of the Lebanese border for the first time ever. Who funds and who supports the Lebanese resistance on the Lebanese border? It's Iran. You know, we've got the Yemenis. Who has supported them throughout their struggle when, again, the world powers conspired against the Yemeni people? They quite literally starved them to death. They were boiling and eating leaves for 8 years, and yet they still stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people and stand with justice. And so Iran, you know, when you ask Netanyahu, for example, who's the greatest threat to you, he will repeatedly say Iran, Iran, Iran. And therefore, that should be a clear sign that Iran is the only entity that is standing in the face of the Israeli occupation entity. It has also funded the Palestinian resistance that before the axis of resistance used to support the Palestinian resistance. Now it is the Palestinian resistance that supports the axis of resistance, because they are positioned in such a strategic location within the belly of the beast, the heart of the Zionist entity. And they've gathered so much strength. Now when we say, you know, is Gaza standing alone? Is anybody supporting it? It doesn't even need anyone to support it. It is now a force to be reckoned with. The Palestinian resistance is a force to be reckoned with. We can now call the Palestinian resistance Arab leaders that are standing up for the Palestinian cause.
And well said, Noor, but I want to interfere here that we have to remind ourselves and the viewers that Iran, from day one of the Islamic Revolution, when Imam Khomeini went back to Tehran, he cut all diplomatic relations with Israel. He expelled the Israeli ambassador, and he gave the building of the Israeli embassy to the PLO at the time when nobody in the whole world recognized it as an embassy for the PLO in Tehran. So the support of the Israeli, the support of the Palestinian case is a clear strategy of Iran from day one.
I don't think that there's any question on the fact that the resistance globally wouldn't be where it is if it wasn't for Iran's stance on this matter. What an incredible discussion. I wish we had time for more. Thank you so much to both of you. And thank you at home. I hope to see you again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن می کند.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allah ya Allah subhanallah. Allah ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allah wa la ilaha
This is a part of a speech of Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, on the issue of Palestine. Essentially, it is the duty of all Muslims to liberate the Quds and remove this nucleus of evil from Islamic lands. Quds is the first Qibla of Muslims and it belongs to them. Muslims across the world should regard the Quds Day as a day when every Muslim is required to join. It is the oppressed people's day.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله dear audience welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from Arab English Radio This is Zainab Musavi and what we do in this program is to talk about some certain speeches and sentences of the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh and then shed light on some points and lessons in these speeches in order to be used by us in our everyday life Well, on the subject of Palestine and the Quds, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, Quds belongs to the Muslims and must be returned to them. Well, the sentence of Imam rahmatullah alayhi is about Palestine as a prerequisite issue for Muslim world. Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi had considered the issue of Palestine as one that was related to the very existence of Islam and stressed that it was a problem which concerned the Islamic world as a whole. He always considered returning Palestine to Islam and uniting it as a prerequisite to saving Palestine and blocking Zionism's expansionist plans. Consequently, while stressing that the main goal of Israel is the destruction of Islam, he repeatedly called on the Muslims to put aside all their differences and unite with one another. In other words, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh made this fact famous that if all the Muslims come together and each one of them threw a bucket of water over Israel, it would be washed away.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi sallallahu alayhi.
Allah. Our great Imam was also aware of the conspiracies of the Satans and the biggest enemies of the Muslims in the world, and believed that Zionists was one of them. And Imam Rahmatullah Alayh had been always an individual who, since the first day of his activities, had a definite positioning concerning his support of the Muslim people of Palestine. This great man of history never forgot the men who were oppressed, and today also his shining thoughts are the light of the path for the Palestinians. And we, as his followers, are supposed to follow this path and support our dear sisters and brothers in Palestine in any way that we can. Okay, dear listeners, it seems that our time for this episode has come to its end. For ending, let's just recite the sentence of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh about Palestine and the Quds once more. In that regard, he said, Quds belongs to the Muslims and must be returned to them. Thank you very much for being with us in this episode of Spring of the Truth. Until another one, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the verses of chapter Nur, the 24th chapter of the Holy Quran, and different commentary points of these verses. Brothers and sisters, now let's listen to the 43rd verse of the chapter.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. أَلَمْ تَرَ أَنَّ اللَّهَ يُزْجِي سَحَابًا ثُمَّ يُؤَلِّفُ بَيْنَهُ ثُمَّ يَجْعَلُهُ رُكَامًا فَتَرَى الْوَدْقَ يَخْرُجُ مِنْ خِلَالِهِ وَيُنَزِّلُ مِنَ السَّمَاءِ من جبال فيها من برد فيصيب به من يشاء ويصرفه عن من يشاء يكاد سنا برقه يذهب بالأبصار.
Do you not see that Allah drives clouds? Then He brings them together, then He makes them into a mass, and you see the rain emerge from within it. And He sends down from the sky mountains of clouds within which is hail, and He strikes with it whom He wills, and averts it from whom He wills. The flash of its lightning almost takes away the eyesight.
So this is the 43rd verse of Chapter Nur. To study creation is the best way for knowing Almighty Allah, which causes to have His love. And all movements in the universe are done with the divine will and power. And this is what we need to understand when we study universe. So in this very verse, 43rd one, I mean, we face a little part of the wonders of creation and the science, wisdom, the magnificence that belongs to Allah and His creations. All of them are the reasons of His pure essence and monotheism. So, the Quran, addressing the Prophet, continuing the previous verses that discuss the knowledge of the Almighty Allah about the praising and having prayer of all the creatures, says, أَلَمْ تَرَى أَنَّ اللَّهَ يُزْجِي السَّحَابَ. Have you not seen that Allah drives gently the clouds? ثُمَّ يُؤَلِّفُ بَيْنَهُ ثُمَّ يَجْعَلُهُ رُكَامًا. Then joins them together, then converts them into a mass. فَتَرَى الْوَدْقَ يَخْرُجُ مِنْ خِلَالِ. And then you see the rain coming forth from the midst of it. The Arabic word yuzj, and the verb yuzji is derived from the word izja, which means to drive softly. And it is the driving that is used for arranging the scattered creatures. And this word is exactly true about the clouds. Every piece of the cloud comes from a place of the seas, and then Allah drives them towards each other with expertise and dexterity, links and condenses them. ثُمَّ يَجْعَلُهُ رُكَامًا. And then He puts them, converts them into a mass. The Arabic word rukam means objects and things that are piled up. And the Holy Quran has used another word here. فَتَرَى الْوَدْقَ يَخْرُجُ مِنْ خِلَالِ. The word, the Quranic word wadq, as many commentators believe, means drops of rain that come from the clouds. But in Mufradat, Raghib has says and believes that it has another meaning, and that is the tiny bits of water that are scattered in the air at the time of raining. But the first meaning is more proper here, so this shows Allah's magnificence more in those enlivening drops of rain, not those dust-like bits of rain. And moreover, whenever the Holy Quran mentions the clouds and descendings of favors, it refers to the issue of rain.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine.
In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
So as we said, brothers and sisters, this beginning part of the verse talks about how the Almighty Allah gently drives the clouds, yuzji sahaban, then He puts them and joins them together, yu'allifu baynahu, and then it makes a mass. It converts them into a mass. فَتَرَى الْوَدْقَ يَخْرُجُ مِنْ خِلَالِهِ And then it is the time that you see drops of rain come out of it. The point is that it is the rain that enlivens the dead grounds and the earth, basically, and covers trees with life, with the dress of life. And this is the water that is needed both for men and animals and all the creatures. This is another point. Now, about another wonderful phenomenon of the sky and clouds, this verse talks about, and it says, and then He sends down from the heavens the clouds like mountains, wherein is hail, afflicting wherewith whom He pleases, and turning away from whom He pleases. This is another wonderful phenomenon of the sky and clouds that this verse discusses, and we'll fully discuss it more in the next episode. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things always work for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
The conversation.
Hello, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we look at the recent legacy bill that was passed at Westminster. How does this now affect victims, and what can be done to repeal it? My next guest is a columnist and regular political commentator on broadcast television. She is also Deputy Director of Relatives for Justice, a national victim support NGO which provides advocacy and therapeutic support for the bereaved and injured of the conflict. As always, we are joined by our resident co-presenter, Michelle Gildernew. Michelle is the current MP for Fermanagh South Tyrone. She has served in the Northern Ireland Assembly as a former Minister for Agriculture and Rural Development and chairperson of the Health Committee, amongst other things. Michelle has been a Sinn Féin activist since her teens and has been elected almost continuously since 1998. And today's guest is Andre Murphy. Andre is a human rights advocate working on behalf of victims affected by political violence during the recent conflict. Andre Murphy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sean. Lovely to be here.
Great to see you.
So, Andre, tell me a bit about your childhood growing up.
Well, I was born in Dublin in the 1970s, grew up in what was, I suppose, a really emerging Ireland at that stage. You know, it was very poor. There was a massive recession, especially during the 1980s. And we were just, you know, a family affected by all of that economic environment. When I was 15, we moved to Talla, which was at that stage a big sprawling housing estate where there was no footpaths. You had to go across fields to be able to get to a bus maybe every hour that ran. And I can remember it just being a little bit grinding. You know, that everything seemed in black and white in Dublin, where everywhere else looked like it was in colour, but I loved it.
And were you always interested in human rights, or where did that come from?
I think growing up in Dublin and what I just described, where you'd be in a place where nobody had any money, and particularly women. And women at that stage had no effective rights. And, you know, I can remember when the marriage bar went in the civil service. Mm-hmm. You know, my mother, because my parents split up, received a benefit called the Deserted Wives Allowance. If you were a child, if you were unmarried at that stage, you got and you had children, you had a unmarried mother's allowance and whatever. That was the type of society we lived in. Yet women ran everything. While men were unemployed or maybe had to go away, women kept Dublin running and the communities that we were in. And I can remember then that sense of, you know, we here have no money. We've no access to effective education. We've got women who are going through all of this. And, you know, where's the rights? Where are we as equal citizens? There is no sense of equal citizenship.
And you became Deputy Director of Relatives for Justice. What kind of, can you just, for the audience's sake, tell us what kind of services that victims can avail of?
Yes, so Relatives for Justice comes from families coming together to say, us too. So people who were affected by state violence in particular, their experience of violence and of violent bereavement was completely dismissed, where they weren't seen as equal victims. And so all of our services, whether it's advocacy where they're pursuing legal justice through different avenues, whether it's recording their own story, trying to break imposed state narratives or censored narratives, or whether it's even seeking support with the traumatic effects of that experience, was very, very difficult for many families. How do you go, if you've been affected by a state violation, to an arm of the state and talk about your life falling apart? You're afraid that the state is also going to perhaps take your children. You're afraid that you're going to be sectioned and taken away from your family. So for us, our support came very, very organically, where we were stepping into the places where the state had failed families. How can you support someone going to an inquest, for example, if they don't have money to be able to pay the rent or to buy food? How can you engage in any sort of education if you can't even walk through the door at night because you're so afraid, because your father was killed at night and you've never been able to cross the door since? Those are the type of organic, connected support services we're able to provide now.
So, Andre, you've been nurturing victims for decades now. How do the people that you work with feel about the latest proposals that have been forced through the British government around legacy?
Michelle, I've been doing this for over 20 years with families who have seen the very worst of days. And the legacy bill is having an impact that I have never seen before. So for them, it is the British government saying their loved ones didn't matter. It's saying that what they did is completely okay. And it's saying they, as living relatives, and their experiences don't matter. It's saying that they are second-class citizens, that they are not beneficiaries of our peace process in any way, shape or form, that they are inconvenient, that they are to be dismissed. So for this is intergenerational. So we can think of people who, when their brother or sister were killed when they were children, they will talk about, on that day we lost our parents as well, because the trauma was so horrendous and the silence descended on their families. So for them to be able to then 10, 20 years later, in the context of a peace process, pursue justice, record narratives, say, let's have due process for my brother or my sister. And their parents pass away and pass on a mantle to them. For this to happen now with this legacy legislation is telling that family that they are not only letting down their brother and sister, they're also letting down their parents. And the devastation... I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. That came out of nowhere. I'm really sorry. The devastation for that family is not about a piece of law. It's not about whether they can get into a court. It is about the erasing of the memory of their child, of their brother, sister, their spouse, their parents. That's what this is doing. And what that does to a family and its impact can only be seen through our phones the day after, where people are expressing suicidal thoughts. They're not just saying, I am traumatised, I'm not coping. They're saying, I want to take my own life because my life is no longer worth living. Not only was the life of my loved one taken away, but my life is no longer worth living. Chris Heaton-Harris was quaffing champagne the night this was passed because they think they've done a good thing, because they don't have to look in the eyes of these mothers who know they are going to die, who are going to die before their children's justice is delivered, the truth about their child, who was not a gunman or a gunwoman, who was not someone that the British Army could just take away and snuff out their life and then cover up the files and hide them away for until 2064 or 2070. Those women know they're going to die without having any of truth and without any justice. Chris Heaton-Harris doesn't have to look in any of their eyes. And it doesn't matter if it was the British Army or the RUC or the IRA or a loyalist that took those lives. Those loved ones mattered. Mm-hmm. And those families matter. And what this is doing is inhumane in an extraordinary way that no one in a developed country in 2023 should even be cognizant of.
And Andre, so what can we do? I mean, what can the general public do, or what can we do to repeal this or to have this reversed?
It occurs to me that there are many people who don't even know what's happened. I think maybe people in the north in these six counties know. People in the south don't know. People in mainland Britain certainly don't know, unless their loved one happened to be in some way caught up in the conflict, maybe as a British soldier who died here, or if they were caught in a bombing committed by the IRA in Britain. That's the only way that they would know, because there has been no There has been no conversation about this. It hasn't impacted. You can tell even that the politicians who passed this haven't thought twice about it, because they don't matter. Irish lives haven't mattered. For people to get involved, they need to start saying these people matter. They need to find out the names of those who've killed. So the Julie Livingstons, the Carol Ann Kellys. They need to find out those names. And then they need to go to the MPs and they need to sit in front of them and say this is wrong. They need to say to the Irish government, who are currently, in fairness, saying this was a unilateral action outside the terms of the Good Friday Agreement in a breach of the peace process. The Irish government needs to know that they have the back of people, that people have their backs when they say we could take this to the European Court of Human Rights as an interstate case. They need to go and do that. And they know they need to go and do it, but they need to know that they have the support of people when they go and do it, because it's a very, very significant step to take. People in America need to really tell the British government this is going to have implications. We said during Brexit that would have financial implications when the British government acted unilaterally because it threatened the Good Friday Agreement. Why isn't that same pressure coming on the British government now from America? Why isn't the same pressure coming on from citizens here? We need to stand up for not only the dead, but also for the families who are living, so that they don't feel that they need to, that their lives are not worth living.
We facilitated meetings in Westminster with some of the victims' families, mm-hmm. and to be honest, there wasn't a lot of interest from MPs in no. Britain. What do you think is next for the victims in terms of the next practical steps?
Practically, we need to put the pressure on the Irish government. We need to say to them about an interstate case that goes to the European Court. There are some families who are working with their lawyers and collectively with law firms where there are going to be challenges that go through the domestic courts. This won't go away. You know, it will just mean that the parents will all be dead. Most of the spouses will be dead. It will be the children and grandchildren of those killed. We are sentencing our two countries to perpetual trauma if we don't resolve this.
Just moving on slightly, Andre, you spoke recently about censorship in the media. Now, we're seeing a change in landscape, obviously, with the proliferation of digital and social media. But just for the audience's sake, just to give them an awareness of how draconian legislation was here for marginalised voices, and I'm thinking of Section 31 in particular. Can you give the audience a sense of what that was like?
It was so much more than just a piece of legislation. It was a way of thinking. Section 31 had always been part of the Broadcasting Act in the South. But in the early 1970s, there was a decision by the government, along with a new RTE, to decide how they would report the North, whose voices they would exclude. We only ever talked about Ireland as the 26 counties, so the North was excluded. The conflict that was raging, the human rights violations that were happening, were completely underreported, to the point that, you know, the Dublin and Monaghan bombings went off when I was a baby, right? I grew up not knowing that the bombs happened, let alone many people blaming the IRA for those bombs having gone off, even though it was the largest single atrocity in the entire of our conflict. And that was the impact of Section 31. It said that the North was other, the voices of those being harmed were other, dangerous, something you didn't want to be engaged in. And it meant then that peace was much harder to achieve. It meant that I think we're still recovering from the imposition of a form of partition where people are, you know, the same, of same citizens, same background, same history. An example might be something like the RTE programme, The Late Late Show, seen on the entirety of this island on a Friday night, the biggest show on the island, on both sides of the border, has a competition and it excludes the six counties, puts a map up, a physical map, where it's like the sea is there instead of the northern six counties. What does that say to all of the citizens who are here? It's saying they're other, but it also says to the citizens in the 26 counties, they are other. It was so effective in doing that. But I think most egregiously what it did was it said to a people who were under militarization, who were experiencing daily violations, that their voices could be silenced. It wasn't just members of the IRA. It wasn't just members of Sinn Féin who were censored. It was also the entire community from which they came. And that was totally deliberate. It was a total political onslaught against a community in, who were engaged in resisting military occupation, resisting the Orange State, resisting discrimination and basic human rights abuses. And, you know, it went way beyond law. It was much more of a mindset. When it was introduced in the British Broadcasting Act too, it compounded the idea that people who were representative of and representing those who had been marginalised and discriminated against could be silenced. So that meant that those violations were silenced too, that they were considered dangerous and somehow illegitimate. It illegitimised an entire community. And then when that community kept on saying, but we want the conditions for peace, we want to build the conditions where there are universal human rights, not partial, not something that was something for one community and not another, then that in some way could be silenced as well. And I think it made the peace process far harder to achieve, sustain and flourish.
And then, so there's a very real and lasting legacy of the legislation. Do you think, is it still difficult? Is the landscape still difficult for those marginalised to voice their opinions? Do you think that, even though the Act itself is gone, the impact is still felt?
I think you absolutely see it. You know, I think that during the conflict there was an idea that state collusion with loyalist paramilitaries, for instance, was Republican propaganda. Since those days, we've had repeated state reports evidencing that collusion. But even still today, you will have people who can say that there doesn't need to be accountability for those crimes. There doesn't need to be any sense of the British government doing anything more than saying we apologise and then moving on. And so they can still form the narrative that this was two communities fighting with each other. The British government was in some way some neutral agent. You know, this legislation is a really good example of that, where they pretend they are neutral and they are only trying to bring reconciliation between these warring communities, when in fact there's something very, very different at work. There's vested interests in saying what this conflict looked like and what their involvement in this conflict looked like. Perpetuate those myths all the time. So it is twice as hard, if not 10 times as hard, for a victim of state violence or of collusion to be heard as a legitimate voice compared to someone who's perhaps affected by Republican actions. And that is really regrettable, because of course we don't want to create a disparity between victims in any way, shape or form. But my goodness, we see words like innocent coming in, or we see all kinds of different variations of how we will treat victims and survivors, or how we will treat narratives of the conflict in any way, shape or form. And that hampers our recovery.
We all know what the British have been trying to do with this legacy bill. We've suffered it within our own communities, British state oppression, for many, many years. We've understood the obfuscation. We've understood them hiding truth for victims for many, many years. This legacy bill only copper fastens what we already know. But thinking from a more international sense of things, and this could be another view, how do you see that this current legacy bill in an international dynamic? For example, the British abroad, and how that affects maybe atrocities being committed in the future abroad.
Absolutely. So I think a big turning point for the debate was when Article 2 was applied to Iraq, where there were victims of British state violence in Iraq in holding centres, essentially. And so the Article 3 and Article 2 of the ECHR was applied. And so all of a sudden you had vested interests in Britain then saying, oh, we thought that we could just go to all of these foreign places and we thought that we could do whatever we wanted and never be held accountable. And then the accountability thing starts to happen, where it isn't just that people release reports or concerns, they actually start to be held to account for their actions, quite like here. And so then they change what they can do. So first of all, they thought they could get away with foreign theatres. They thought that if they committed the violations in Afghanistan or Iraq, they would just create an environment of amnesty for those actions. But then they realised that they would have to do it here as well, because families were securing tiny, tiny measures of accountability for British state actions on this island. So they've created amnesty for all of it. And that has got to be of concern to the international community. The idea that a sovereign nation, who is a founding signatory to the European Convention, to the International Conventions on Human Rights, that they would be able to circumvent all of their human rights obligations, go to any country, carry out the most egregious of violations, and then count themselves completely unaccountable. Surely that has to worry the entire international community.
But unfortunately, we haven't heard enough condemnation either. And I think that's where we need to, that's the next step.
I think you're right. I think that you can see the human rights community. So the United Nations have said this is terrible. The European Commissioner for Human Rights has voiced concerns. But the nation states haven't. Mm. We haven't seen that engagement from the states. And that's the difference to Brexit, where there was a rogue state attitude around leaving the EU and their way of leaving the EU. The states got involved because they could see that it was in their interest to do it. On this, families have been completely abandoned and human rights have been completely abandoned by the nation states. And that's who we need to, you know, it would make a quantifiable difference if we saw the kinds of commentary that we had seen from the likes of Luxembourg or from the Swedish nation or whatever around Brexit. If we started seeing that around legacy, I think it could make a big difference.
Well, Andre, we're all very proud of your work, the work that you and Mark do at Relics for Justice. And want to thank you for coming in today. It's always good to see you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay. Thanks a million.
This week we take a look at the use of censorship during the recent conflict. Both Section 31, enacted in the Irish Republic, as well as the British broadcasting ban, were deployed to marginalise growing support for Sinn Féin. With the party as popular as ever with voters as they've ever been, was censorship a wise decision in hindsight?
Censorship has been widely deployed as a tool to silence radical or alternative voices during the recent conflict. In 1971, Fianna Fáil Minister for Justice Gerry Collins invoked Section 31 of the Republic of Ireland's broadcasting ban, forbidding broadcasters to interview or report statements by anyone speaking on behalf of a number of organisations, the most prominent of which was Sinn Féin. The Labour Party Minister, Conor Cruise O'Brien, further strengthened the ban in 1977 in an effort to halt the increasingly sophisticated media communication skills of the party. A similar ban was replicated by Britain in October 1988. The restrictions, announced by the Home Secretary, Douglas Hurd, covered 11 organisations based in the north of Ireland. Broadcasters quickly found ways around the ban, chiefly by using actors to dub the voices of banned speakers, with the renowned actor Stephen Ray becoming the voice of Gerry Adams. The restrictions caused difficulties for British and Irish journalists, who spoke out against censorship imposed by various other countries, such as Iraq and India. After the legislation around Section 31 lapsed in January 1994 in the Republic of Ireland, the British Prime Minister, John Major, lifted the broadcast ban on the 16th of September 1994, a fortnight after the first Provisional Irish Republican Army ceasefire, declared on the 31st of August 1994. For the first time in many years, a level political playing field saw marginal and alternative voices emerge from the cold.
And that does it for another week. We'd love for you to join the conversation by sharing the link to today's programme to help us grow our audience across all our social media platforms. I'd like to thank our special guest, Andre Murphy, and our resident co-host, Michelle Gildernew. In the meantime, the conversation will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. I'm Sean Murray. Bye for now.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri wa salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
We were looking at the topic of how do we survive living in an ocean of corruption, that we are surrounded by temptation all around us, and that we are struggling for the most part to stay afloat, to be able to preserve our identity as Muslims, as believers, as followers of the Ahlul Bayt. May God's peace and blessings be upon them. And one of the things that I did highlight last night that I just want to further elaborate on in 1 or 2 minutes is, although the discussion last night was aimed